This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast. Way up.
Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors. Welcome in. I'm Mark Cox. Bo Matthews along with us here, and of course producer Carl Middleman with some fantastic bumper music this morning. Carl,
did you guys listen to that up there?
We did not, oddly enough.
You should have sang it every morning when you were there.
Yeah, Carl, you would have.
I was in Alaska.
From my Alaska fishing trip, and it was a great time. And I just have to tell you, if it's an opportunity that ever comes in front of you, please take it if possible.
Loved it. It's so beautiful up there.
Would you say, since Carl, you've fished Canada and Alaska, is one or the other better?
It's different. It's because you're fishing for different things up there. You know, like when you grew up in Minnesota, you knew that certain lakes had certain fish and others had others.
Right.
Mark went for salmon.
Yeah. So first of all, because anybody that's listened to the show, sometimes, you know, for years I've been living vicariously through you, Mark Cox, because you vacation like a boss, you RV, you do all these, you know, things. And so you've really inspired me. And I think maybe the show inspires people. Tell us, like, word for word, I mean, you know, step by step, the travel, was it a pain in the butt to get up there?
It's like flying to Europe, and that's something I was not prepared for, because, you know, I'm just going to Alaska. It's just like another U.S.
state,
except it's way the hell far away from here. And there's no easy way to get there. Like, there's no direct flight, I don't believe, from St. Louis to Anchorage. So if you fly in Delta, you have to go through, let's say, Minneapolis. You have to fly up there, transfer planes, and then there's a direct flight from Minneapolis. I was shopping for the lowest airfare I could find at the time and found an American Airlines flight. So I had to fly south to Dallas, 2 hours south, and then catch a plane. And then it was a 7-hour trip to Anchorage. I was on that.
And that was a direct flight?
You could almost get to England or Ireland in less time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've flown from here to Rome, and I think it was a 10-hour flight. So it was a long time on a plane, and it's not one of those big overseas airliners. I mean, it's just it's a decent size in Airbus, but still, it's not.
So that was direct from Dallas to
direct
Anchorage
from Dallas to Anchorage, 7 hours almost.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was a long flight. So the travel time is an issue, because we had plans to fish Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We had to be at the cabin by Wednesday afternoon, and we had 8 guys going. We all had to coordinate to get there at the same time so we could get in the rental cars to get up there. So I had to leave on Tuesday, got there late Tuesday night, almost midnight Wednesday morning, spent the night in a hotel in Anchorage. We got up the next morning. We got the rental cars. We went out and went shopping and bought the supplies, bought some adult beverages, as you can imagine. And then we continued up there. Here was the thing. Another thing I learned: when you go up to Alaska to fish like that, you have to carry a cooler with you. Now, you don't have to, but these guys have determined that it's a second piece of luggage. You just check it empty, or in this case, it did have some nice packaged bottles of bourbon to fly up there inside of the cooler.
Ooh.
Because on the way back, those bottles were empty, and I didn't need that space anymore, so we filled it with fish. So I had a cooler to bring the fish back in.
What size really cooler are we talking? How big?
I don't know how many quarts. I mean, just a standard Coleman size cooler. This one happened to have wheels on it and a handle.
Ooh,
but you know,
only way to go.
Pretty good size.
Which you'd
cooler.
Bring to a tailgate.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, it was a good time. Here, I'll tell this story very quickly. I've flown with a weapon twice, I think. So I get, just to refresh myself, because it's been a couple of years, I get on the TSA website, and it says very clearly, TSA regulations, if you're going to fly with a firearm, it has to be unloaded, obviously, in a hard-sided case that you can lock, and you can leave the magazine loaded, but it has to be out of the gun and in the same hard-sided case.
Locked.
So I arrive at the airport, I've got my Glock 20, 10 millimeter. I go up to the American Airlines counter, because you have to check in and declare that you have a firearm. Lady goes, okay, I need to see it. I need you to open it up. So I get the case out of the luggage. I unlock it. I open it up. And she looks at it and she says, the magazine is loaded. And I'm like, listen, lady, I checked TSA's website before I came here, and it said that you could fly with the magazine loaded as long as it wasn't in the handgun. It's clearly not. Okay. She goes, oh, those are TSA rules. American Airlines rules are different.
Oh.
So note to anybody listening to this, TSA rules aren't all you have to know. You have to know the specific airline rules.
Okay, so what happened?
She said you have to fly with the bullets in a separate, not a separate case. They can be in the same locked case, but they have to be in a box. Well, I didn't have a box with me. Ugh. So I fortunately got to the airport 2 hours early. Guess what I had to do? My car was already parked in the long-term parking. I got an Uber to the Bass Pro Shop in St. Charles.
No
I
way.
Bought a, to buy a $4 plastic box I could put the bullets in, and so that cost me $40 to get over there and back with a $4 plastic case, so that I could take the bullets out of the magazine, stick them in a plastic case inside of the same case as the gun. This is the stupidity of the American system. It's just stupid. What difference does it make if it's inside a locked box? But those
there was no. She was not wavering at all.
Not
right?
Waver. This
well,
is
it's not her fault.
This is American Airlines. It's just the stupid rule American Airlines has. So anyway, I get up there. I fly up there. I fish. I'm getting to the airport to come back. It's Montana. I mean, it's Alaska. Right? It's like Montana. I walk up to the counter and I tell the lady, "I got a firearm." She goes, "Okay. Is it unloaded?" I'm like, "Yeah." She goes, "Okay." I said, do I need it open? And she goes, no. She just gave me the thing to sign and slapped it on there.
They're used to it.
And I left, because mm-hmm. they're so used to it up there.
Wow.
But in St. Louis, they're so puckered over you flying with a weapon that they had to, she was enforcing the ridiculous rule to the letter. It was so frustrating that they don't make it more clear than that. But it was, I guess ultimately it was my fault for looking at the Transportation Security Administration rules and not the American Airlines rules.
Well, that's a good note. And this is what we learn on this show. Was there, I mean, yes, you were there in plenty of time. You parked long-term parking.
Yeah.
Was there any worry that you weren't going to make it back in time for the flight?
No, I had plenty of time. And the Uber driver was great. He waited on me and then took me back to the airport. So that worked out well. So to the fishing was fantastic. We arrived in Anchorage. We rented cars. We drove. It's about an hour and a half, maybe a little less than that, to a place called Cooper's Landing, which is toward the west of Anchorage. You have to go around an inlet, a big ocean inlet there where the tides are either, people surf the tide. The tide comes in so fast on this river, people go out and they surf it as it's coming in. It was really wild. So we had to drive around that to get to a place called Cooper's Landing, which is near the Kenai River. A beautiful lodge, Alaskan Heavenly Lodge is what it was called. I posted a picture up on my Facebook page there on the Mark Cox Show on Facebook. And then we got up at 3 a.m. the next morning, met the guide, drove 45 minutes to where we put the boat in the water. And it took us probably another 30-minute boat ride to where we fished. We just got out and we had our waders on, and the, you know, the water's ice cold, but the temperature was 45 degrees, warmed up to 60. I mean, they had Chamber of Commerce weather in Alaska while I was there. The guys said they hadn't seen three consecutive days of weather that good in months.
All you, Mark.
Wow. It didn't rain. We had blue sky two of those 3 days. It was pretty amazing. So we had great weather. The water was cold, but you're layered up, and you got a pair of sweatpants or insulated pants on under the waders. And it was fantastic. Now, we fished with fly rods, probably 9-weight fly rods, I would have to imagine.
Except, and did you bring that, or no, did they
provide the guide that? Provides everything.
Okay.
And you don't, it's not fly fishing, because these fish are spawning. So they're not eating anymore. They're going upriver to lay their eggs and die. So, but they still move their mouths as they take in water as they're going upstream. So all you do with this fly rod, it's got a weight attached to a swivel, and then it's got another probably 2.5 or 3 feet of line beyond that with a hook and a little bit of, it almost looks like a fly, but it's like just a little piece of fluff attached to it.
Okay.
And you cast it out in the river, maybe 8 feet out, and then you drag it back in. What you're hoping to do is to get that hook into the mouth of one of those fish and then set the hook.
And could you see them? Could you see the fish through the water?
You could. You with polarized glasses on, you could see them. The water was obviously very clear. They do blend. Yeah. They do blend in really well. And if probably 3 or 4 feet out, you get to a point where you can't see them anymore. But some of them would swim close enough to where you were in the water that you'd see one on occasion. These fish probably averaged 7 pounds each, 7 or 8. A couple of the ones I caught were 10 or 11. And
nice.
You talk about a fight. These salmon, these coho salmon are obviously they've been in the ocean. They're a solid muscle. And when you hook them, they run. And they say just let the drag wear them out and then reel them back in when they stop running and let the drag wear them out. And, you know, the biggest one I caught, it probably took me 10 minutes to land it. I mean, it was a pretty good fight.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a pretty good
fight.
That's
so cool.
Here's the best part. There were 8 of us. The limit is 6 fish.
For the whole trip?
No, per day. And,
okay.
And on no given day did all 8 of did we limit out as a group. But we came close, right? All 3 days. So when we went back to the fish processor to pick up our frozen fish to fly back, we had 316 pounds of salmon fillets.
Nice.
Now, obviously, the carcass of the fish gets thrown back in the river, and bears and birds eat them. Just fish fillets, we had 316 pounds of fish.
Damn.
And we just all divided it equally. And, you know, I've got 40 pounds of fish in my freezer. It's fate. Great.
I'll wait for the invite for the fish.
I hear you.
I said that too.
That's what Carl Middleman keeps hinting at.
Everybody's like going to say that to you,
man. Yeah, exactly.
What are you going to do with 30 pounds of salmon?
That's a good question. I should probably share it, shouldn't I, Carl?
You should.
So the reason for the firearm, we talked about this before you left,
yes,
was in case you had a bear encounter. Did you even see any, or did you wrestle him to the ground? What happened?
I wrestled me a bar while I was up there. No, actually I had a different vision in my mind of what this area was going to look like, probably because I watched National Geographic too often. The river where we were fishing actually gets kind of deep in the middle, the Kenai right there. And while they have seen bears before on these trips, we didn't see any this time. And it's a more, where you're fishing along this river is a more populated area than you think. Like, there weren't houses right where we were, but they weren't that far away, to be honest with you. And there are quite a few people because there's fishermen out there every day. Further down the river, it narrows out a little bit, and I think that's where the bears tend to go, because we didn't see any. We saw one moose crossing the road, saw several
nice
eagles, but not a lot of wildlife. Not like I expected. I mean, it's gorgeous. It reminded me a lot of Montana. There were snow-capped mountains off in the distance, and the water was ice cold. It was just beautiful. It was a trip of a lifetime. If you ever get
that's
a chance
great,
to do
man.
It, it's something to experience, I'm telling you.
And have you had a lot of fly fishing experience before this?
Well, again, it's not technically fly fishing. So while I have done some fly fishing, this is just basically using the rod to flip the weight out in the water and then dragging it back in. So you don't have to really worry about that technique of being able to, you know, whip the rod back and forth and get the right action.
Okay.
And lay the fly out there. And then you don't have to worry about any of that. It kind of really takes the stress away from that. For sure.
That's exciting, man. Wow, congratulations.
It was a great time, I have to tell you.
Yeah. And what was the name of the, I mean, if somebody wanted to look this up, did they just Google something or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was in Cooper's Landing. There are a bunch of guides there. I'm sure you can find it online. And we stayed at there's a bunch of lodges there, too. We stayed at one called the Alaskan Heavenly Lodge. It was beautiful log cabin-looking lodges, and it was just perfect. It was a great.
Would you do it again?
I absolutely will do it again.
Did you eat any of the fish while you were there?
We did not. We had some we had some raw on the riverbank while they were carving it, but we didn't cook any of it for sure. Hey, coming up, there's been a big ruling on the AR-15 ban in a different state than Illinois. What impact might it have here? We'll check in with Aiden Johnston from Gun Owners of America coming up.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age. Wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. MIDI clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. MIDI offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's join, M-I-D-I.
Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors. Alongside Mark Cox, my name is Bo Matthews. Carl Middleman, our executive producer, putting us all together. And this segment is proudly brought to you by Razorback Armory. They are on Manchester Road, just east of 270. If you've never been in, please go in, check out what they've got to offer. If you're wanting to customize or refurbish or accessorize your firearm or suppress your firearm, go to RazorbackArmory.com for more details and get into the store. Now, there's lots of movement going on in the Second Amendment world. And this past Tuesday, Mark Cox had Aiden Johnston on to talk about this federal judge overruling New Jersey's ban on AR-15. So, Illinoisans, you definitely want to listen up for this and see how this was done. But take it away.
Federal judge ruled today that New Jersey's ban on AR-15 rifles is unconstitutional. The judge said his ruling is a result of the Supreme Court precedents and suggested that Congress and the president could do more to curb gun violence. 9 other states and the District of Columbia have measures similar to New Jersey's ban. New Jersey has some of the strictest gun laws in America. New Jersey's attorney general says he will appeal.
If you ban them in the future, the bullets will have been shot and there won't be any more available.
So you don't shoot deer with a bullet that size? If you do, you could cook it at the same time.
Put that double barrel shotgun and fire 2 blasts outside the house.
That is without a doubt the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
All right, Aiden Johnston with us this morning from Gun Owners of America. And Aiden, great to have you back. How are you?
It's great to be here. I'm doing very well, thanks.
Yeah, you know, the Second Amendment is always on the ballot because the people we elect today in the Missouri primary, I'm sure there are other elections maybe around the country, but the ones we elect today in the Missouri primary, some of them are going to Congress, some of them are going to end up in the General Assembly or the governor's office, and we have to know that those people have our back.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the Second Amendment is incredibly contested in these elections. There are always politicians who want to take away your Second Amendment rights. So it's important that gun owners get out and vote because there are millions of gun owners who don't even vote every election, let alone vote for their Second Amendment. So definitely, if you're listening and you own a firearm, please go out and vote for your Second Amendment rights.
Amen. Amen on that. Let's talk about this New Jersey decision. I think this happened when I was actually took a few days vacation last week to go fishing, and I tuned out of the news process. But what I'm reading here on this case in New Jersey is that the judge, they have an assault weapons ban. They call it an AR-15 ban in New Jersey, just like they have over here in neighboring Illinois across the river. And this judge found exactly what I expect the Supreme Court to rule when it gets there, the Illinois case, is that this was unconstitutional under Bruin and Heller.
Yeah, it's nice to come back to some good news for once. This judge did rule that the ban on so-called assault weapons was unconstitutional. And both Heller says that you have a right to have a firearm in your home, so the government shouldn't be able to ban you from having an AR-15 in your house. And then Bruin actually says you have a right to carry that firearm for self-defense in public, which the New Jersey Supreme Court or the New Jersey judge did not say quite yet. But it did also rule that if a law is going to be held constitutional, then it has to comport with the text and the history of the Second Amendment. And the text clearly protects the right to own an AR-15. That right shall not be infringed. And also, the Founding Fathers did not restrict the ownership of military-style weapons. Unlike what Biden says, you could own a cannon at the founding. So clearly, this judge, in ruling that AR-15s are protected, was complying with Heller and Bruin.
Yeah, yeah. Well, did gun owners play a role in this particular case?
This is not our lawsuit. This is the lawsuit from another group, the Firearms Policy Coalition, and very well done to them. We have our own lawsuits also in different states. We're particularly fighting that Illinois assault weapons ban, which the Supreme Court did not decide to rule on yet, but may still take up by the time we get back on appeal. So.
Yeah.
There's other cases pending on assault weapons. There's a lot of movement. There's a lot of great precedent that the Supreme Court has given us lately. And so there's actually some hope for gun owners if we're able, that we might be able to be successful here.
Well, it just couldn't be any more clear to me. And this ruling spells it out very clearly for the case in Illinois as well. If I live in the state of Missouri, I'm free to go to a gun range, pass a federal background check, and buy an American sporting rifle. Just across the river, Americans who live there are not. That is an infringement upon their Second Amendment rights, that they cannot go do that. And I'm frustrated that it's been around as long as it has, and J.B. Pritzker keeps rubbing people's noses in it.
Yeah, and they're really, American citizens should not be living in a two-tiered system like that, where some states you have a Second Amendment and other states you don't, and it's been totally infringed upon. I think that's awful, and I really don't understand why the Democratic Party wants to take away these lawful Second Amendment protected self-defense firearms. I mean, people use these firearms to protect their homes, to protect their families every year. It's very important that we not disarm people, especially in a country with as much crime as we do. But nevertheless, the Democrats seem to want to let criminals run loose and instead take away your firearms and blame you, the law-abiding gun owner.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I saw there was an alert that, which is interesting because it came out of Pennsylvania from gun owners, because the Governor Shapiro had a gun control bill, but most of the funding of that was eliminated from the Pennsylvania budget, which is which was good news, right? I mean, because this guy might end up as the vice presidential candidate before the day is over.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's extremely important that every single year our lobbyists and our teams are combing through state legislature budgets. I'm combing through the federal budget that they're trying to put together right now to find all those gun controls, because there's always some legislator who slipped in something into the hidden report language to try to enact some gun control. And we have to expose that, call it out. Gun owners have to actually hold their elected representatives accountable by sending emails and postcards and making phone calls. But then we can actually get stuff removed. And that's a win for the Second Amendment. So don't only vote after the elections. You still got to hold your politicians accountable.
Well, it's a good point. I would direct people to gunowners.org, because you guys are really on the front lines of a lot of these legal challenges around the country. Aiden, thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. We appreciate it. And it's been great having me on.
Yep. Great having you, buddy. Thank you. Appreciate that. Aiden Johnson there from Gun Owners of America. This thing was interesting because I don't know if Shapiro ends up getting the nod from Harris today or not, but he's another one of these progressive, just like J.B. Pritzker, left-wing governors who has an office of gun violence prevention. He's picked an inanimate object and attached its name to violence. How about an office of violence prevention? Because it might be a knife or it might be a pickup truck or a car that they run over somebody with. But that's not it. It's all aimed at there wouldn't be an office of, free speech violence prevention. But they're willing to go after your Second Amendment rights. And that's why I keep hammering on this. What we do today at the polls matters. It's not a multiple choice test. You need to elect people that are going to go up and defend that. And particularly in Congress, right? Because Shapiro, if he is to get elected as vice president, will continue to push this agenda along with Harris in Congress, in the Senate, trying to pass a ridiculous ban on a modern sporting rifle. My modern sporting rifle has shot rabbits. It shot at a coyote one time and it missed. I don't know how that happened. I mean, but it's never jumped out of its safe and shot at a human being. Isn't that weird?
That is shocking.
It is.
Yeah, I thought a lot of guns just did that.
I've been keeping an eye on them for a long time.
They're jumpers.
I've never seen one do that. Mm. It's the strangest thing. It's a phenomenon the left needs to wake up to, for sure.
And just a reminder to share this show with other Second Amendment supporters and those that love the great outdoors. And we do have a great outdoors segment of this show. And coming up next, we'll be talking to Andrew Branson from the Missouri Department of Conservation's fisheries programs. He's a specialist that's going to talk about, I don't know if you've heard about this, northern snakehead fish. They are arriving in Missouri. We're going to find out all about it coming up next on Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors.
Welcome back to Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors. Now we switch back to fishing and the issue of something odd that's been found in the waters in the state of Missouri. In fact, it was Bo Matthews that pointed this out to us and found this story on Instagram. Carl?
A strange invasive fish that can live out of water for several days has been found again in Missouri. It's called the northern snakehead fish. According to the Department of Conservation, the northern snakehead is an invasive species that is native to Asia, but considered aggressive predators here in the U.S. Unlike most fish, the northern snakehead can breathe air and can slither across land. Conservationists say if you find one, you should kill it and report the location where you found it.
Yeah. After you freak out that there's a fish crawling towards you, right?
That's right. Oh, my gosh. Dude, when I saw that, I was like, what in the world are the scientists doing out there? I've never heard of this.
I don't know. But we have Andrew Branson from the Missouri Department of Conservation Fisheries Program on the phone with us right now. He's a specialist with them. And Andrew, how are you?
Well, I'm doing just fine. Yeah, happy to be here. I wish we had a better topic to talk about, but it's something we need to get the word out on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess first things first, how do these get introduced into waters here in the U.S.? I mean, if they're not native, it doesn't sound to me like this is the kind of thing you'd keep as a pet. Was it intentional?
Yeah, they were, again, they're native to mainly Asia, but they were legally brought into the United States many years ago, I think. I think it was 2002 that they actually first showed up, actually swimming in our waters, and that was up in Maryland. But, yeah, they were legally brought into the U.S. prior to that for live fish markets as a food fish, and actually even the aquarium trade. These are hardy fish, and they did well in home aquariums. And actually, before I started working with the Conservation Department, I actually worked in the aquarium trade and out on the West Coast, and in the little pet store I was working at, we actually sold little snakeheads, believe it or not.
Wow. No kidding.
So anyway, they've been in the United States for a while, but again, back in 2002 is when they started showing up, like I said, in Maryland, in native waters. So they at that point, I'm sure it was, they were illegally released. You know, people weren't supposed to release these fish, but yeah, that is kind of the brief history and when they first showed up in the United States.
So would you say, Andrew, that they've migrated naturally here, or do you think people are transporting them around the country?
Yeah, it's more of a transport, I believe. If you look at a map of where they show up in the United States, if it was a natural migration, you would think they would just slowly spread out from Maryland and they'd be in all the waters between there and here. But it's not that way. It's a patchwork here and there. They made it into Missouri from Arkansas. In 2008. Arkansas discovered they had an established population there in Arkansas, and it was just a matter of time before they worked their way into Missouri. And our first report of them in Missouri was in 2019.
Wow. So one more thing we can blame on Arkansas.
And China. And
they did come from there, yeah.
To try to read into that. So tell us more about the snakehead. Obviously, the ones you had in the pet store were small. How big do they get? What kind of threat do they pose?
Yeah, they were small, but they did get big. And people with larger aquariums, they would seek out these fish. They can get up to 30 inches, 32, 33 inches. So it's a pretty good-sized fish. After my work at a pet store, I then actually worked at a large public zoo, and we often had large snakeheads brought in. They had been confiscated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department, because in the state I was at the time, they were not legal to have in that state. So these larger ones were brought to us, and they were usually in home aquariums and yeah, they can get quite large. And again, like I said, they can get up to 30 inches or more.
They are definitely wild looking. Is there pictures on your website that people can go to make sure they get those in their memory bank and then, or look at it on their phone to make sure this is the northern snakehead that they need to be aware of and that they need to, dispatch?
That's right. Yes. If you go to the Missouri Department of Conservation's website and just type in snakehead, you'll bring up images of the snakehead. And we also have an identification image because snakeheads, they do closely resemble a native fish in Missouri. And that is the bowfin. The bowfin is also a fish that gets similar size to a snakehead. It's similar in shape. It's long and thin, kind of torpedoed shape. So they are often misidentified. People will catch a bowfin and they contact us thinking it's a snakehead, and most of the time it's bowfins. Again, if you go to our website, you can see pictures of snakeheads. You can see how they compare to a bowfin. The biggest difference is that the bowfin, the snakehead has a long fin that runs along its back, and the bowfin has a long fin that runs along its back. But the snakehead also has a long fin that runs along its belly to the tail, whereas the bowfin does not. So the snakehead has that long fin on the top, long fin on the belly, but the bowfin does not. So that's a quick way to tell.
Andrew, the one big difference is the snakehead could actually crawl into your tent, so that would be another giveaway, right?
That might be another one if you see something going across the ground like that. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, what do they do out of the water? Are they looking for food? Or do they stay out for long? I mean, what can you tell us about that?
Right. No, they actually they don't want to be out of the water, but that is something they can do if they're forced to leave the water. Like, say, the water source they're in is drying up or conditions, aren't favorable and it wants to get out of there. But no, they're a fish. They want to stay in the water, but they do come to the surface and breathe air. They gulp air. And the bowfin, like I was talking about earlier, it's also a Missouri fish that can come up and gulp air. So that's not totally unique to the snakehead. But the getting out and moving on land is a little more unique to snakeheads. But again, snakeheads, they don't normally do that. They're not traveling on land as a normal thing. It's like I said, if something's drying out, where most fish would just they'd be stuck in that little river or stream or hole that's drying up. They're kind of stuck there. These fish can move on to another area. And again, they're hoping when that happens, they're just hoping to kind of find something nearby. They're not traveling like that long distances, but that is definitely unique that a snakehead can do something like that.
Yeah, I bet. So are you likely to catch them while fishing for something else? I mean, are they caught accidentally? I know they're not a game fish, but they see a worm on a hook and they're going to bite it, kind of thing?
Yeah, pretty much. They're just a predatory fish, and most fish, I guess you could say, are kind of that way. Most fish will eat just about anything they can bite at and get in their mouth. So yeah, people are probably fishing for bass and different things like that and other game fish, and they just happen to catch one of these. They're people fishing for catfish, maybe using stink bait or something like that. They're not likely to bite on that, but seems like just about everything likes a wiggly old worm on a hook, or a bait fish if you're fishing with minnows or even lures. That's you're likely to catch one. Now they're not statewide yet, so that's a good thing.
Boy, you got the answers, buddy. I got two questions real quick. Actually, three. Are they poisonous, number one? Number two, are they doing damage to the other ecosystem or the other fish in the ecosystem? Are they killing them or whatever? And what spices would you use to cook them?
Well, I'll answer the last one. I have never eaten one, so I'm not sure what would be the best way to cook. As far as damage and things like that, yeah, that's what invasive species do. They're a non-native animal or even plant. I mean, you can have invasive plants, but anything invasive is a non-native thing to the area that rapidly spreads and outcompetes native species. So that's the threat, and that's the threat they pose. I can't say we're seeing game fish numbers going down or anything at this point, but that's that's the fear. They are spreading very quickly, and as far as what they eat, they're eating the same thing the other fish are eating. They're eating the same thing our other native fish are eating. So they're eating, they're just now a new introduced, like I said, rapidly spreading animal that's now competing with all of our other fish, and it can outcompete them.
Well,
and are they poisonous though?
Oh yeah, no, they're not. Not that I've heard of. They've got snake in their name, but I have not heard they're poisonous or venomous or anything like that.
And the video, Andrew Branson, our guest from the Missouri Department of Conservation, the video I saw when its mouth was open, it looked like it's got small teeth. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. It does have small teeth, and which is not unusual for fish. There's lots of native fish in Missouri that have teeth. Of course, the gar, the long-nosed gar, most people can imagine the teeth in that. But other fish, like walleye, have teeth, and lots of fish, various sizes. But fish having teeth, is not unusual. I mean, again, those teeth, they're just used for grabbing onto things. They're not injecting any venom or anything like that, but they would be a fish that if you caught it, you wouldn't want to put your thumb in its mouth to hold it, because it's got teeth in there.
Well, it looked like the head like pulled back and the teeth like retracted
like
pushed
movie
out.
Alien?
It was the weirdest thing. As soon as I saw it, I sent it to Carl and Mark. I was like, dude, you got to see this.
Frankenfish, oh my gosh. I think is what they called it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Xenomorph.
Yeah. No, I've not heard of that. I've not heard that the teeth can actually move or anything. But a wide open mouth might expose those teeth a little more. And then when the mouth closes, they might be a little more hidden. So
Andrew, I know the most recent one was found in southwestern Missouri. What are the locations then? If that's the fourth one, what are the four locations where they've been discovered?
Well, let's see. I'm not sure. I haven't heard of one in southwest Missouri. Right now, they've all been southeast Missouri. So if there was a new report in the southwest, I have not heard of that one. But Right now, the majority of them are come in southeast Missouri, and that would be kind of in St. Francis River area. Right. We've got a Duck Creek Conservation Area that has them. And again, that's directly north of the Arkansas areas that they're found, and they've mainly been in eastern and northeastern Arkansas. So that's, you know, where that meets up with us. That's where we're finding them. But they could eventually spread into the current river area, the 11 Point River area, and below Lake Wapapello. But so that's where we're seeing them. And if people catch one, again, we encourage them to go to our website, type in snakehead, and they'll find information. And they need to identify if it's a bowfin, our native bowfin, or actually a snakehead. And then if it is a snakehead, we have a reporting form where people can go online and actually report where they caught this fish. And they can take a picture and upload a picture as well if they've got that. But we want people to be on the lookout for these, be able to identify it, and report it if they catch one.
Very good. Andrew Branson, Missouri Department of Conservation, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Yep. We'll talk to you. We'll talk to you again, I'm sure.
Bo, something to look forward to on your next float trip.
Yeah,
huh?
How about that? Dip your foot in the water. There's a snake fish down there. It doesn't sound like they're maybe aggressive, that they're going to attack you or anything, but they do have a funny looking head on them, don't they?
Well, they do, and it's something kind of like the murder hornets that they you know threaten us with. I never saw one of those. I have been seeing these dragonflies that have these like black markings on their wings. And I'm kind of convinced that it might be a Chinese drone that is flying around the country, because I've never seen it before. And now all of a sudden, here they are.
They're everywhere. Yeah. All over the Matthews estate down there, for sure.
Well, officially, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good
to have you back.
Great stretch of weather. I think I brought that back with me from Alaska.
Thanks.
Enjoy the weekend. Yeah, no kidding. That'll do it for this edition of Second Amendment Radio in the Great Outdoors.
See you, boys.
What it takes to love me like I want to be loved by you.
Get more at 971talk.com.
Welcome back to Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors. Now we switch back to fishing and the issue of something odd that's been found in the waters in the state of Missouri. In fact, it was Bo Matthews that pointed this out to us and found this story on Instagram. Carl?
A strange invasive fish that can live out of water for several days has been found again in Missouri. It's called the northern snakehead fish. According to the Department of Conservation, the northern snakehead is an invasive species that is native to Asia, but considered aggressive predators here in the U.S. Unlike most fish, the northern snakehead can breathe air and can slither across land. Conservationists say if you find one, you should kill it and report the location where you found it.
Yeah. After you freak out that there's a fish crawling towards you, right?
That's right. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Dude, when I saw that, I was like, what in the world are the scientists doing out there? I've never heard of this.
I don't know. But we have Andrew Branson from the Missouri Department of Conservation Fisheries Program on the phone with us right now. He's a specialist with them. And Andrew, how are you?
Well, I'm doing just fine. Yeah, happy to be here. I wish we had a better topic to talk about, but it's something we need to get the word out on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess first things first, how do these get introduced into waters here in the U.S.? I mean, if they're not native, it doesn't sound to me like this is the kind of thing you'd keep as a pet. Was it intentional?
Yeah, they were, again, they're native to mainly Asia, but they were legally brought into the United States many years ago. I think it was 2002 that they actually first showed up, actually swimming in our waters, and that was up in Maryland. But they were legally brought into the U.S. prior to that for live fish markets as a food fish, and actually even the aquarium trade. these are, you know, these are hardy fish, and they did well in home aquariums. And actually, before I started working with the conservation department, I actually worked in the aquarium trade and out on the West Coast. And in the little pet store I was working at, we actually sold little snakeheads, believe it or not.
Wow. No kidding.
So anyway, they've been in the United States for a while, but again, back in 2002 is when they started showing up, like I said, in Maryland, mm-hmm. in native waters. So they at that point, I'm sure it was, they were illegally released. You know, people weren't supposed to release these fish, but yeah, that is kind of the brief history and when they first showed up in the United States.
So would you say, Andrew, that they've migrated naturally here, or do you think people are transporting them around the country?
Yeah, it's more of a transport, I believe. If you look at a map of where they show up in the United States, if it was a natural migration, you would think they would just slowly spread out from Maryland and they'd be in all the waters between there and here. But it's not that way. It's a patchwork here and there. They made it into Missouri from Arkansas. In 2008. Arkansas discovered they had an established population there in Arkansas, and it was just a matter of time before they worked their way into Missouri. And our first report of them in Missouri was in 2019.
Wow. So one more thing we can blame on Arkansas.
China. They did come from there, yeah.
To try to read into that. So tell us more about the snakehead. Obviously, the ones you had in the pet store were small. How big do they get? What kind of threat do they pose?
Yeah, they were small, but they did get big. And people with larger aquariums, they would seek out these fish. They can get up to 30 inches, 30, 32, 33 inches. So it's a pretty good-sized fish. After my work at a pet store, I then actually worked at a large public zoo, and we often had large snakeheads brought in. They'd been confiscated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department, because in the state I was at the time, they were not legal to have in that state. So these larger ones were brought to us, and they were usually in home aquariums and yeah, they can get quite large. And again, like I said, they can get up to 30 inches or more.
They are definitely wild looking. Is there pictures on your website that people can go to make sure they get those in their memory bank and then, or look at it on their phone to make sure this is the northern snakehead that they need to be aware of and that they need to, dispatch?
That's right. Yes. If you go to the Missouri Department of Conservation's website and just type in snakehead, you'll bring up images of the snakehead, and we also have an identification image, because snakeheads, they do closely resemble a native fish in Missouri, and that is the bowfin. The bowfin is also a fish that gets similar size to a snakehead. It's similar in shape. It's long and thin, kind of torpedoed shape. So they are often misidentified. People will catch a bowfin and they contact us thinking it's a snakehead, and most of the time it's bowfins. So, yeah, again, if you go to our website, you can see pictures of snakeheads. You can see how they compare to a bowfin. The biggest difference is that the bowfin, the snakehead has a long fin that runs along its back, and the bowfin has a long fin that runs along its back. But the snakehead also has a long fin that runs along its belly to the tail, whereas the bowfin does not. So the snakehead has that long fin on the top, long fin on the belly, but the bowfin does not. So that's a quick way to tell.
Andrew, the one big difference is the snakehead could actually crawl into your tent, so that would be another giveaway, right?
That might be another one if you see something going across the ground like that. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, what do they do out of the water? Are they looking for food? Or do they stay out for long? I mean, what can you tell us about that?
Right. No, they actually they don't want to be out of the water, but that is something they can do if they're forced to leave the water. Like, say, the water source they're in is drying up or conditions, aren't favorable and it wants to get out of there. But no, they're a fish. They want to stay in the water, but they do come to the surface and breathe air. They gulp air. And the bowfin, like I was talking about earlier, it's also a Missouri fish that can come up and gulp air. So that's not totally unique to the snakehead. But the getting out and moving on land is a little more unique to snakeheads. But again, snakeheads, they don't normally do that. They're not traveling on land as a normal thing. It's like I said, if something's drying out, where most fish would just they'd be stuck in that little river or stream or hole that's drying up. They're kind of stuck there. These fish can move on to another area, and again, they're hoping when that happens, they're just hoping to kind of find something nearby. They're not traveling like that long distances, but that is definitely unique that a snakehead can do something like that.
Yeah, I bet. So are you likely to catch them while fishing for something else? I mean, are they caught accidentally? I know they're not a game fish, but they see a worm on a hook and they're going to bite it, kind of thing.
Yeah, pretty much. They're just a predatory fish, and most fish, I guess you could say, are kind of that way. Most fish will eat just about anything they can bite at and get in their mouth. People are probably fishing for bass and different things like that and other game fish, and they just happen to catch one of these. They're people fishing for catfish, maybe using stink bait or something like that. They're not likely to bite on that, but seems like just about everything likes a wiggly old worm on a hook, or a bait fish if you're fishing with minnows or even lures. That's you're likely to catch one. Now they're not statewide yet, so that's a good thing.
Boy, you got the answers, buddy. I got two questions real quick. Actually, three. Are they poisonous, number one? Number two, are they doing damage to the other ecosystem or the other fish in the ecosystem? Are they killing them or whatever? And what spices would you say would you use to cook them?
Well, I'll answer the last one. I have never eaten one, so I'm not sure what okay. what would be the best way to cook. As far as damage and things like that, yeah, that's what invasive species do. They're a non-native animal or even plant. I mean, you can have invasive plants, but anything invasive is a non-native thing to the area that rapidly spreads and outcompetes native species. So that's the threat, and that's the threat they pose. I can't say we're seeing game fish numbers going down or anything at this point, but that's the fear. They are spreading very quickly, and as far as what they eat, they're eating the same thing the other fish are eating. They're eating the same thing our other native fish are eating. So they're eating, they're just now a new introduced, like I said, rapidly spreading animal that's now competing with all of our other fish, and it can outcompete them.
Well,
and are they poisonous though?
Oh yeah, no, they're not. Not that I've heard of. They've got snake in their name, but I have not heard they're poisonous or venomous or anything like that.
And the video, Andrew Branson, our guest from the Missouri Department of Conservation, the video I saw when its mouth was open, it looked like it's got small teeth. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. Though it does have small teeth. And which is not unusual for fish. There's lots of native fish in Missouri that have teeth. Of course, the gar, the long-nosed gar, most people can imagine the teeth in that. But other fish like walleye have teeth. Mm-hmm. And, lots of fish, various sizes. But fish having teeth, is not unusual. I mean, again, those teeth, they're just used for grabbing onto things. They're not injecting any venom or anything like that. But they would be a fish that if you caught it, you wouldn't want to put your thumb in its mouth to hold it, because it's got teeth in there.
Well, it looked like the head like pulled back and the teeth like retracted or pushed out.
Alien?
It was the weirdest thing. Soon as I saw it, I sent it to Carl and Mark. I was like, dude, you got to see this.
Frankenfish, oh my gosh. I think is what they called it, right?
Yeah.
Xenomorph. Yeah. No, I've not heard of that. I've not heard that the teeth can actually move or anything, but a wide open mouth might expose those teeth a little more, and then when the mouth closes, they might be a little more hidden. So
Andrew, I know the most recent one was found in southwestern Missouri. What are the locations then, if that's the fourth one? What are the four locations where they've been discovered?
Well, let's see. I'm not sure. I haven't heard of one in Southwest Missouri. Right now, they've all been Southeast Missouri. So if there was a new report in the Southwest, I have not heard of that one. But right now, the majority of them are come in Southeast Missouri, and that okay. would be kind of in all the right. St. Francis River area. Right. We've got a Duck Creek Conservation Area that has them. And again, that's directly north of the Arkansas areas that they're found, and they've mainly been in eastern and northeastern Arkansas. So that's where that meets up with us. That's where we're finding them. But they could eventually spread into the current river area, the 11 Point River area, and below Lake Wapapello. But so that's where we're seeing them. And if people catch one, we encourage them to go to our website, type in snakehead, and they'll find information. And they need to identify if it's a bowfin, our native bowfin, or actually a snakehead. And then if it is a snakehead, we have a reporting form where people can go online and actually report where they caught this fish. And they can take a picture and upload a picture as well if they've got that. But we want people to be on the lookout for these, be able to identify it, and report it if they catch one.
Very good. Andrew Branson, Missouri Department of Conservation, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Yep. We'll talk to you. We'll talk to you again, I'm sure.
Bo, something to look forward to on your next float trip.
Yeah,
huh?
How about that? Dip your foot in the water. There's a snake fish down there. It doesn't sound like they're weird. Maybe aggressive that they're going to attack you or anything, but they do have a funny looking head on them, don't they?
Well, they do, and it's something kind of like the murder hornets that they threaten us with. I never saw one of those. I have been seeing these dragonflies that have these like black markings on their wings. And I'm kind of convinced that it might be a Chinese drone that is flying around the country, because I've never seen it before. And now all of a sudden, here they are.
They're everywhere. Hey. Yeah. All over the Matthews estate down there for sure.
Well, officially welcome back.
Thank you. It's good
to have you back.
Great stretch of weather. I think I brought that back with me from Alaska.
Thanks.
Enjoy
Thank you
the
that.
Weekend. Yeah, no kidding. That'll do it for this edition of Second Amendment Radio in the Great Outdoors.
See you, boys.
What it takes to love me like I want to be loved by you.
More at 971talk.com.